It's half past eight.
It's half past eight New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike gives you a chance to test your wits against four super wits. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more plus a 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid, and all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, the literary critic of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please, uncabined, uncribbed, and unconfined, continues on its way. And tonight our board includes the sports expert and nature writer, John Kieran, the lyricist and conductor of the New York Post's Conning Tower, Mr. Franklin P. Adams, the music critic, composer, and radio personality, Deems Taylor, and as our special extra guest, Donald Ogden Stewart, who has written the screenplay of the Ernst Lubitsch picture, That Uncertain Feeling, now showing at the Radio City Music Hall here in New York. Now remember, for each question that's missed, Lucky Strike rings up $25. And that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. We're off with our first question. It comes to us from Mr. Robert Rosenzweitz of this city. What have these numbers in common, gentlemen? 60, 24, 7, 12. Come, come. 60, 24, 7, 12.
60, 24, 7, 12. They're nice numbers.
They are. Time, gentlemen, time.
60.
I've given you the answer.
Oh, time.
Time, get it?
Oh, you get
it. Yeah. Can you explain it to us, Mr. Taylor?
60 minutes.
Oh,
an hour.
I see.
Yeah,
oh,
get it?
So
7 days in a week, et cetera.
You despise the question, eh?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to charge you $25, courtesy of Lucky Strike, for that.
Well, it was worth it, Frank.
Instead of the Britannic. Mr. Adams, you look puzzled.
64?
I said 60, 24, 7, and 12.
Oh.
Were you listening to me?
I thought you said 64.
Oh, I suppose we ought to do this all over again.
Ask us again.
No. All the numbers are units of time. $25. Thank you. Well, that's the way to start. Now, the next one.
This is fun, you know.
I like it, do you, Mr. Taylor?
Easy money. I could have answered that.
May I read this question, Mr.?
You don't mind?
Comes from R. Dexter Studwell of Porchester, New York. It's 2 out of 3 on this. Each of the following lines is spoken or written by a parent to a child. Each of them appeared in a play. Just tell me the play in which the lines appeared. Here's the first. Then you'll go to Yale, and you'll stay there till you graduate. That's the answer to that. Muriel's got good sense, and you haven't. What play is it from?
Probably.
May I guess, Mr. Taylor?
It's probably something that Mr. Stewart wrote.
No, I don't think so.
I said Princeton in my play.
What play was that?
Rebound.
This one you possibly ought to be able to get because you got mention of Yale. You're a Yale man, aren't you?
Yes, I am indeed.
Well, you should know everything about every play that was ever written
but
about
I don't
Yale.
Know anybody named Muriel.
That's what you say.
Well, it's nice to have you clear yourself publicly on this platform.
I'll probably get 24 letters after this broadcast.
The play is Our Wilderness, and the lines come from Act 4 of Our Wilderness by Eugene O'Neill. Well, that gives us one wrong and sends us merrily on to the next set of lines. Now, what play do these come from? Here I disclaim all my paternal care, propinquity and property of blood, and as a stranger to my heart and me hold thee from this forever.
Shakespeare.
And
Maxwell Anderson.
I beg pardon? Maxwell Anderson, you might like to hear you say that, Mr. Stewart.
I said it. Maxwell Anderson, and I think it was Winterset.
Well, that is the nicest compliment ever paid to Mr. Anderson, who writes very good plays.
I think it was W. Shakespeare and I Don't Know What.
He never wrote that. It was called What You Will, not I Don't Know What.
Twelfth Night.
No. Mr. Kieran?
I don't know.
It's King Lear. King Lear. By Shakespeare and Maxwell Anderson, apparently. It is King Lear speaking to his daughter Cordelia. Casting her off, perhaps you remember that now. Well, that's not easy.
I must read that.
The next one's even harder. Here we are. Clarence, there are things about women that I think you ought to know. Yes, got that already? Mr. Kieran?
Life with Father.
Life with Father, yes. Who's explaining what to whom?
Well, a red-headed father is explaining to the oldest of four red-headed sons.
Yes, and what is he explaining?
About women.
About women. And does he get anywhere with the subject, Mr. Adams?
Well, he gets as far as I ever do.
Well, that is not far enough. We've gotten only one out of three on that, and that sends $25 to Mr. Studwell, a set of the Britannica, both courtesy of Lucky Strike, and sends us on. We're doing very well so far.
At bat two, hit zero.
This one comes from E.F. Abramoff of the City. Again, get two out of three. In what motion picture, gentlemen, is each of these photographs an important part of the plot? In the first case, it's a photograph of a hired man. A photograph of a hired man. In what motion picture, Mr. Taylor?
They knew what they wanted.
That's right. How does it work into that picture?
She marries someone by correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
But the gentleman who wants to marry her sends his hired man's picture instead of his own.
That's right. Because it's handsomer. That's right.
Yes.
That's quite right.
It's Humphrey Bogart, isn't it?
Very good. Now, how about this photograph? A photograph of a wedding ceremony. A photograph of a wedding ceremony. In what picture, or play, or both, does that photograph appear as part of the plot? Mr. Stewart?
The Philadelphia Story.
Philadelphia Story. Very good. Yeah.
Who wrote the script of that?
It's an MGM picture.
In this case, the photograph in question is one of a confidence man and his daughter. A photograph of a confidence man and his daughter. A recent picture. Oh, I remember seeing it a couple of months ago. Oh, we got that one wrong. That's from The Lady Eve, starring Henry Fonda and Barbara Stanwyck. Remember that now, Mr. Stewart?
Yes, indeed.
You do. That gives us one wrong, which is okay. This is the first question we have got right so far. What can you do with this one? Coming from Effie Johnson of Shady Point, Iowa. Can you give me four lines of poetry that mention parts of automobiles? Parts of automobiles. Is that perfectly clear? Do you want me to start you off with an example?
I think it'd be a wonderful idea.
Well, Dryden, I think, once wrote a play called Love's Last Shift. Would that do, Mr. Taylor?
Oh, wonderful.
Like that?
Yes.
But let us have a line of poetry.
Oh.
We're doing very well so far.
Yes, I feel an awful sense of responsibility tonight.
Well, suppose I give you... Suppose I start you off.
Parts of a car.
I beg pardon, Mr.
Parts of a car.
Parts of a car.
Could it be a poem that I wrote?
Oh, yes, yes.
Can I write it now?
Yes, I'll accept it. You have me hard-pressed, Mr. Stewart. Go ahead.
The gears of my heart.
The gears? Gears of
the
your
gears mind? Of my heart.
That'll do.
I don't think I'll let you go on.
See me after class.
Mr. Kieran?
I was just trying.
Mr. Kieran?
Put on your old gray bonnet.
Oh, that's a peach.
Sure.
You see how easy it is, Mr. Stewart? Nothing to it.
Oh, yes.
Mr. Taylor?
Break.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, great.
I suppose you want to figure those are three parts.
Well, one break was out of order, you see. There's only three.
Mr. Adams?
One with Nineveh and Tyre.
Oh. Getting better and better. Mr. Kieran?
Turn, fortune, turn thy wheel. With thee we go neither up nor down.
That's
it. Shakespeare, Tennyson.
Tennyson and not Maxwell Anderson. All right, that gives us four out of four.
And the hub of the universe.
The hub of the universe. That's for Boston, yes. It's not a line of poetry, but it's a well-known phrase. How about this one from Alfred Fisher of Bloomfield, New Jersey? Get two out of three. These pairs of men had the same last name, and they were all cabinet members. Who are they? Now, the first pair of first names, Philander and Frank. Who were they? Oh, we have four hands. Mr. Stewart.
K-N-O-X.
K-N-O-X. Yes, you can pronounce it. Knox. Who was Philander Knox?
He was awfully nice.
Well, I didn't ask for a character sketch.
He was in the cabinet.
Whose? Presidential cabinet,
yes,
I suppose.
Yes, of course, the presidential
cabinet.
And I don't remember exactly the year.
Well, that's putting it very well. Mr. Taylor, can you help us out with who was Philander Knox?
Philander Knox, I'm probably wrong, but he was probably Secretary of State.
That's very right. That's quite correct. Secretary of State under whom?
Under guess who? That's...
That's it. It was under Taft. You don't have
Taft.
To know that.
William Howard Taft. Yes,
and, of course, Frank Knox.
We present Secretary.
Present Secretary of the Navy. Now, how about the this pair?
Who?
Jefferson and Dwight. Jefferson and Dwight. Mr. Adams.
Davis and Davis.
Davis and Davis. Who was Jefferson Davis?
Jefferson Davis was president of the Confederacy.
Yes, but that's not the cabinet post he held. The other cabinet post in the Union. What post? Any ideas?
I don't know.
Of Labor.
He was Secretary of War under the president after whom you were named, Mr. Adams.
Franklin F. Pierce.
Yes, Franklin Pierce. And Dwight Davis, gentlemen?
Secretary of War.
Under whom, Mr. Adams?
Under Mr. Coolidge.
Under Mr. Coolidge, is quite correct. Now the next pair, Henry and Henry. I don't think I differentiated those correctly. Henry and Henry. That's the best I can do. Mr. Adams.
Wallace?
Wallace, yep.
And Wallace.
Wallace and Wallace. That's quite right. Father and son.
A small world, isn't it?
They held what posts, Mr. Adams?
Secretaries of Agriculture.
Yes, under what president?
Under Franklin Roosevelt.
Yes,
and under...
Pick a president.
Hoover.
No, Harding. Harding. Oh, you got the first. You got the initial correct. All right. It's very good. We got three out of three on that. That's very good. Now, on the next, which comes from Harriet Sampson of New York City, you will have to exert all your musical ability. I'm going to ask you to identify three out of the four excerpts in a musical medley that you are now going to hear. If you can give me the four, all the better, but at least three. Go ahead. Gentlemen. Mr. Taylor, will you start us off?
Well, number two is from Pinafore.
Yes, and what is the selection
we
called?
We Sail the Ocean Blue.
We Sail the Ocean Blue.
Sassy Ships of Beauty.
Very good, Mr. Adams and Mr. Taylor. Now, Mr. Stewart.
Oh, My Darling Nellie Gray.
Very good. Where did that appear in the medley? Do you remember at what point?
The third one, I think.
It was the third one, Mr. Kieran. You're quite right. That gives us two out of four. Of course, those are the two easy ones.
We need one more, don't we?
Now, the other two...
We couldn't have that first one again.
Do you want it again, Mr. Stewart?
I've always...
Smile at me. Well, even though you did what you just did then, I'll have it played again. Go right ahead.
The one I knew went the other way. It went the
other way. See, that music... Yeah, it's a funny thing that they... Two of the selections out of the four are highly popular, and you got those right off the reel. The other two are so-called good music, Mr. Taylor.
I'm going to be disgraced for life if I don't guess that first number.
Good music, very good music.
An old experience.
I won't have it played again, gentlemen. I'm awfully sorry. The first part of the medley is from the First Symphony of a man named Beethoven, Mr.
Taylor.
All
right, I shoot myself.
All right. Wait till 9 o'clock. And the last part came from the Second Hungarian Rhapsody of Mr. Liszt.
But I don't care for that one.
And that sends another $25, courtesy of Lucky Strike, to Miss Sampson, and a set of the Britannica.
Now, boy, how the money rolls out.
Doesn't it, though? So far, Lucky Strike has paid out $75 and three sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
And we ain't began yet.
And now, Mr. Cross, Mr. Cross reports on a place of business where anything can happen.
That's right, Mr. Fadiman. Anything can happen at a tobacco auction, because tobacco is sold in the open market, in open competition, where anyone can bid, anyone can buy. And at auction after auction, the American Tobacco Company pays the price to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobacco. For example, at Asheville, North Carolina last season, American paid 34% more per pound for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 34% above the average market price paid for all the various types and grades of tobacco sold there. And the best we bought will go to Lucky's. And so it goes at market after market. Now, just what does this mean to you as a smoker? It means greater smoking enjoyment from Lucky's finer, milder tobaccos. And, Mr. Fadiman, don't you agree that's just what smokers are looking for these days?
I should think it would be, Mr. Cross. And I timed you at exactly 55 seconds. Now, how about this one, gentlemen, from Doris Clogis of St. Louis, Missouri. Identify these ships, all of which are described in poetry that you should know. The first ship is the Victor ship. Quote, the Victor ship, close quote. Mr. Kieran.
That's from Captain Oh My Captain.
100%, Mr. Kieran.
Walt Whitman.
Very good. Can you give us the line?
Victor ship comes back with object one.
Yes.
Isn't that
from,
it?
From fearful trip, the Victor ship,
comes
in with object one. Now, I think that's picking up pretty well,
goodbye,
Mr. Kieran. Now, how about the next ship, which is a capital ship? A capital ship. Mr. Adams.
For an ocean trip was the Walloping Window Blind.
Walloping
by
Window
Charles
Blind.
Edward Carroll.
Very
from Davy
good.
And the Goblin.
That's a perfect response. Go to the head of the class, Mr. Adams. And how about the third ship, which is a painted ship? A painted ship. Mr. Stewart.
As silent as a painted ship upon a painted ocean.
You mean idle?
Either idle or silent.
No, idle.
Boy, does he cost us a fortune.
And that was... Don't I get something on that?
Idle is quite correct, as Mr. Adams gently reminds you. And the lines, Mr. Stewart, are from what
poem? The Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
That's very good.
1811, 1873.
Is that true?
In a way.
Things you know. The last ship is simply a tall ship. A tall ship. Mr. Kieran.
I think that's Maysfield, you mean.
Yes, and there's something
I must go down to the seas again.
Go ahead.
For the call of the trumpeting tide is a strong call. And a...
Well, you've skipped a couple of lines. Yeah, those are lines are very good, too.
Strong ship and a tall ship.
Oh, I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea and the sky, and all I ask is a tall ship.
You start a steer up.
Atta boy. And you had that on the tip of your tongue, Mr. Taylor?
Absolutely.
That's what I thought.
It's still there, as a matter of fact.
That's from Maysfield Sea Fever, as Mr. Kieran reminds us. That gives us 4 out of 4. You gentlemen are improving with practice. Here's one from Campbell Smith of Newark. Get 2 out of 3. In what sport or game does the player with the highest score usually need the fewest opportunities to score? Mr. Kieran.
Well, billiards, for one.
Billiards? How do you make that out?
Well, if you get... A high run in billiards, you beat the fellow who doesn't get the high run, and you might start up and run out your string, 400 or 300 if you're
playing. Oh, you mean you're not up at the table?
No, you get up once. The other fellow might have been up twice or 6 times while you were up twice, and you win.
That's perfectly true.
That might be also in pocket billiards, popularly known as pool.
Yes.
You get 125 to nothing.
That's quite true. And
you
it also would be true of the game of bowling.
It has been done.
I wasn't allowed to go around pool rooms.
It's too late to try to fix up your moral character on this program, Mr. Stewart.
I don't know.
In the game of bowling, the Mr. Kieran,
that's right.
The
that's
player
right.
with the
bowling
highest, you get strikes and...
Do less work.
Yeah, that's right. Don't you have to get up only once instead of twice. Now, in what sport or game does the player stay up as long as he scores? Mr. Stewart.
Cricket.
Cricket, yes. How'd you happen to know that, Mr. Stewart?
I read a book about it.
Mr. Adams, did you have another answer
cricket.
For it?
Cricket. So-and-so and none-up.
Yes, and I should say also in handball, Mr. Kieran, wouldn't you? The player stays up as long as he scores. And similarly in billiards?
In billiards he does.
In billiards he does, that's right. And what game does the winner take away the loser's equipment? Mr. Taylor.
Strip poker.
Well, yes, yes, that's true. That's perfectly true. And you would call that what, a sport or a game, Mr. Taylor?
Lots of fun.
That wasn't the one I was thinking
you
of,
mean,
gentlemen.
You mean rowing, where they take the shirts off the backs of the losing crew?
No,
custom.
That's poker, where they take the shirts off.
I'll accept Mr. Taylor's ready response, but the game that I was angling for is the game of marbles. Don't you remember? Pick up the marbles. The winner takes away all the marbles. You remember that, Mr. Adams?
Yes, but that isn't his equipment. His equipment is
his thumb? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I think that's splitting hairs. I think his equipment consists of his marbles. But I'll accept Mr. Taylor's response. Now, on this one, gentlemen, get 2 out of 3 if you can. This comes from K.J. Barrows of Winchester, Massachusetts. What nationality or group did each of the following try to liberate? And the first is Toussaint Louverture. Toussaint Louverture, Mr. Stewart.
The people of Haiti.
Yes.
The
period.
Period.
That's right.
I still have 6 words left in the telegram.
Just stick with Mr. Adams and you'll be right. People of Haiti. And otherwise known as the Haitians, I believe.
And he was known as the Black Napoleon.
He was known as the Black Napoleon, Mr. Taylor. Now, how about Spartacus? He tried to liberate what group? Mr. Taylor.
The gladiators.
Of what city?
Rome.
Of Rome, yes.
They call him chief, and they do well to call him chief.
I know a poem about Toussaint Louverture, but I didn't say it.
Well, that's awfully nice. Well, that's what I call cooperation on your part. The when did Spartacus do all these tricks, Mr. Taylor? Any idea?
Oh, in the early 80s.
Oh, no, he was about 42 when he died. B.C. or A.D.?
Well, I would say 80.
Well, I would say B.C., and I would be right, because I can read it off the
card. I'm the only one who knows who wrote it.
Who wrote the speech?
The Reverend Elijah Kellogg.
Oh, are you still thinking of that? Those lines you were reciting.
Wrote Spartacus to the Gladiators.
Very good. That's true. How about Lord Byron? What group did he try to liberate? Mr. Kieran.
The Greeks.
The Greeks.
From the rule of the Turks.
From the rule of the Turks, yes. When was this, Mr. Kieran?
Well, that was about 1826, 7.
Well, I think that the fight against the Turks did last until that time, but his own, he died in what year?
He died in Missolonghi about 24,
24,
was it?
Yes. 24. Mr. Stewart?
May I recite a poem?
Why, yes.
The mountains look on Marathon, and Marathon looks on the sea.
Yes, we've often had that on this program. That's very good.
You mean he dreamed that Greece would still be free?
And musing there an hour alone, he dreamed that Greece might still be free. Is that, am I talking too much?
Not a bit, not a bit. Only you don't seem to have any original words of your own. How about this one from Henry K. Krauskopf of Cincinnati? Get 2 out of 3. Now, gentlemen, if you arrived at the opera in the middle of the performance, as I'm sure Mr. Taylor does whenever he can, and heard each of these arias, what opera would you be attending? Now, you're going to hear 3 of them, and you have to get 2 out of 3. What opera would it be? Let's have the first. About that, Mr. Adams? Was that your hand I saw up?
It was my hand, but I don't think I'd be there. It might be La Bohème.
It might be. It isn't. No, it isn't. No.
It's Joe Green.
It's certainly Joe Green.
Joe Green?
Giuseppe Verdi.
Oh, Mr. Verdi. I get it. I get it. Then pick an opera, Mr. Taylor.
Yes, I'm picking one.
Trovatore.
No. You picked the wrong one, Mr. Stewart. How about it, Mr. Taylor?
No, it's one of those middle ones that I don't care much about.
All right.
I should say Traviata.
Traviata is correct.
Yes.
Traviata is right. That's very good. A Force Louis, Mr. Taylor. Now, do you remember it?
Oh, too well.
All right. Now, we'll have the second one. About that.
That's one I wouldn't care for.
You and opera are hardly on singing terms, Mr. Taylor, are they? Mr. Stewart.
I was going to say The Barber of Seville, but...
Keep quiet. You said it. That is correct. The Barber of Seville. Una voce poco fa, Mr. Taylor. Stewart is a tower of strength, Mr. Taylor.
Yes.
For you.
I should say.
Now the third and last of them. Thank you, Miss Hastings. And now, Mr. Taylor, be careful.
Last I know one.
Good.
Yes, it's the closing scene of Aida.
Ah, that's good, Mr. Taylor. You feel pretty good now, don't you?
No, I just a little bit rehabilitated, that's all. Say, if operas were as short as that, I'd go.
How about this one, gentlemen, from Helen G. Wager of Alpine, New York. It's about forests. In what work of fiction did a forest do the following things? Get 2 out of 3.
Macbeth.
Evangeline.
Now you
Evangeline.
What did you say, Mr. Adams?
I said Evangeline.
Why did you say that?
Well, I just kind of guessed.
Well, you're right. And what did you say, Mr.
Macbeth?
That you're right, too. Well, I guess we're through with this question. I'll read the question anyway. The first part of the question was, in what work of fiction did a forest grow where a village once stood? Mr. Adams?
Yes.
Very good. And now
pines in the hemlock. That's
right. This is a completely spontaneous and unrehearsed program.
I get laughing.
Now, in what work of fiction did a forest move? Mr. Kieran?
Macbeth. That's right. And Wood went to Dunsinane.
That's very good. Now we'll get on to the third part. No one's mentioned this. In what work of fiction did a forest transform the lives of those who entered it? Mr. Stewart?
Midsummer Night's Dream.
Would you defend that answer?
Would this be a play?
This would be a play.
The Petrified Forest.
I never saw it and wouldn't know. Would that be right? Have you seen it, Mr. Stewart?
Matter of fact,
what do you mean
no.
about would I defend it? Don't they people become other things in that period?
Yes, that's true. That's Question true. Mark. That's true. Bottom is transformed.
That's right.
I think I would accept it. I was thinking of Dear Brutus by James Barry. Everybody who went into the forest saw his life as it might have been if he'd chosen another way of life. But I think your answer is correct. What was yours, Mr. Adams, the Petrified Forest?
Petrified Forest.
I'll accept that as good, too. Now Mr. Cross invites us to step into somebody else's shoes.
Yes, Mr. Fadiman, I wish everyone here, just for 1 minute, would try to fit himself into the following picture. You're an independent tobacco expert. You spend your life buying, selling, and handling tobacco. You see who buys what tobacco, the prices they pay, and the quality they get. Now, if you were an independent tobacco expert, wouldn't you smoke the cigarette you thought contained the best tobacco? Undoubtedly you would, and the chances are over 2 to 1 that you'd be a lucky strike smoker. You see, at 119 tobacco markets, markets that handle 96% of all the cigarette tobacco sold at auction in this country, the American Tobacco Company last season paid higher prices to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder leaf. And the best we bought will go to Lucky's. No wonder that the independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, and warehouse men smoke Lucky's 2 to 1. Why not let their expert judgment guide you in the selection of your cigarette?
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out $75.03 of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Stewart and Mr. Taylor, for coming to our party tonight. And next week, our three regulars, Mr. Kieran, Mr. Levant, and Mr. Adams, will be on hand. And as our guest, we are glad to announce a man known to us as a scholar, an athlete, and perhaps more recently as a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy, Mr. Gene Tunney. Remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. If the question stumps our experts, you not only get $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now we'll listen to a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, the famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
And that chant, fully interpreted, ladies and gentlemen, means Lucky's pay the price to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. With independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, warehouse men, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2 to 1.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.